There was a time when there were even fewer controls over the motion picture industry than today. It's known as pre-code Hollywood, and that is the subject of Eileen Dugan's interview with film historian Thomas Doherty.
Mention of 1930s Hollywood cinema evokes images of Busby Berkeley musicals, sophisticated comedies, and westerns in which good always conquered evil. But, especially in the early years of the decade, there are more explosive images of gangsters unchecked by police, of exotic women preying upon man after man, of vice unpunished and triumphant. Why were so many films of the 1930s so filled with the violent, the sexual, the lurid? And what efforts were made to sanitize Hollywood movies in their wake? With us today to discuss the underside of 1930s American film is Dr. Thomas Doherty, chair of the Film Studies program at Brandeis University. Professor Doherty is the author of the recent book Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930 through 1934. Welcome, Professor Doherty.
Hey, good to be here.
We often hear references to the code, but apart from thinking about it having to do with sex and the late Hedy Lamarr running around naked, we tend not to know what it was really about. What did the code involve?
Well, the code was, rather than, say, a list of prescribed activities like running around naked, although it was that too, was basically a moral vision that the production code wanted to make sure that Hollywood taught the right lessons, and those lessons tended to be things like the virtuous are rewarded, the guilty are punished, and that civil and moral authority are always upheld. So it isn't just sort of prescribed language or images or, you know, gore, the kind of things we laugh at and are really easy to signpost, but it's a much broader sense of the world being moral and ordered that Hollywood promulgates under the production code.
And who wanted this done?
Well, a lot of people wanted it done, or at least a lot of elites and religious organizations who thought that the messages Hollywood was sending, particularly in the early 1930s, were too salacious, too violent, too immoral, too chaotic for cultural well-being, particularly the cultural well-being of young people, because they thought that that although adults can watch images of violence or sexuality and not be adversely affected because an adult's moral character is formed, a young person going to the movies seeing these things is going to be adversely affected because he's an impressionable youth who hasn't got a sturdy religious upbringing yet. So women's organizations, religious organizations, and a good deal of editorial newspaper editors and educators, the kind of groups that today you wouldn't think of as being pro-censorship, back in the 1930s, looked upon the movies as a baleful influence.
You focus upon the years 1930 through 1934 because you make the point that actually there wasn't much being done to crack down upon these movies that were a little more salacious. I mean, why was it that the code was being violated so willfully?
Well, in 1930, the code is actually written. The phrase pre-code is something of a misnomer, because anything before the onset of censorship in 1934 could be considered pre-code. But the film scholars and film programmers tend to date the era from 1930 because that's the date the production code document, which, you know, gives all these, this list of prescribed activities and the moral vision, is actually written. It's written by a Jesuit priest named Father Daniel Lord. But it's not got an enforcement mechanism until 4 years later. The censorship is being done in Hollywood, but the people doing the censoring are the movie moguls themselves. So it's really a paper tiger until 1934, when it's given a strict enforcement mechanism, and most crucially, it's given a chief in the form of a guy named Joseph I. Breen. And when Joseph I. Breen takes over the Production Code Administration, which is formed in 1934, that's when you see the movies turn on a dime. That's when the movies go from being this sort of chaotic pre-code universe into what we think of as that, you know, classical Hollywood cinema of moral order and temperate behavior.
Well, let's talk about this wild, unbridled universe for a moment in the movies. In your introduction, you make reference to the wildly eccentric films, how they were more unbridled, salacious, just plain bizarre compared to what followed. And can you give us some examples of those?
Of sex or bizarreness?
Oh, whatever you like.
Favorite movies of unbridled sexuality of the era, in fact, a lot of people, two movies, are Jean Harlow in Redheaded Woman and Barbara Stanwyck in a film called Babyface. Redheaded Woman was from MGM in 1932, Babyface from Warner. Oscars the next year. And in both of these films, these women sort of play these immoral vixens who sleep their way to the top, you know. And of course, the way they do it and the language and the attire is, you know, very salacious and licentious. But I think what's more odd about them from, you know, a production co-perspective is that neither of these women is really punished for her behavior. At the end of Redheaded Woman, Jean Harlow, you know, has a millionaire French husband and a chauffeur lover played by Charles Boyer, and that's how the film ends, after she's, you know, slept her way to the top. And Barbara Stanwyck pretty much thrives the same way. She works her way up through a savings and loan company one floor at a time, and, you know, ends a wealthy woman. That film actually has an attached-on kind of production code ending, which nobody believes, in which she's a little bit punished, but the entire 80 minutes of the film validates her behavior. For bizarreness, I think one of the best examples might be a film like The Island of Lost Souls, with Charles Laughton as the evil doctor. It's one of the first versions of the famous H.G. Wells short story, in which he's breeding a tribe of half-animal, half-humans and trying to get them to procreate with a man. And that's the kind of thing you're certainly not going to see after 1934.
Yeah, that latter movie was recently remade as The Island of Dr. Moreau, as I recall.
Right, that was the original title, but I think at the time people, they changed because they didn't want people to think it was a medical story.
But it's interesting how we... It's interesting, though, how we tend to associate 1930s women with Katharine Hepburn, the strong-willed character, and yet even she would appear in some films in which her character wasn't exactly moral. But we do have these very predatory women like Marlene Dietrich or Greta Garbo and Barbara Stanwyck again. I mean, why was that?
Well, I think one explanation might be their fantasies of female empowerment in an era in which women have very little power, and especially economic power. And one way for women, you know, traditionally, you know, the old way to get ahead would be by using their sexual wiles and not being punished for it. And that's what happens during the code. Maybe the best example of a figure who does this, of course, is Mae West, who, sashays her way through any number of narratives and always gets the better of the men, both in terms of, witticisms and in terms of the economy as well.
And another aspect of film that was very controversial were the gangster films.
Yeah.
Why was that?
Well, gangster films, I think it wasn't just the violence of the gangster film that put off critics, and it might be difficult for us to recapture that if you look at a film like Little Caesar, Public Enemy, or Scarface. Those are the big three, the most controversial and the most influential. That in the context of the time, these films really were violent. And they don't, of course, by our standards, they seem, you know, very, very placid. But audiences hadn't seen that mixture of sort of machine gun violence and ruthless killing before on the screen. Part of it is because sound had just come in, and sort of the roar of the Tommy gun and the screeching of tires had a visceral excitement for those audiences that we might miss today. And the fact that they are engaging in violent, chaotic behavior and succeeding seems to really unnerve political authorities. There was no genre more controversial than the gangster film. I think, a comparison today might be some of the arguments you have about violence in movies or on the internet, inspiring young people to, you know, to go out and shoot their classmates in high school. They were that same kind of deep fear that these films had an incendiary and insurrectionist impact on American moviegoers. And in the era of the Great Depression, this is particularly urgent because this is really a time of social unrest and economic chaos.
We can imagine the effect that the gangster films might have on people, or that the predatory women might have, but even Tarzan and Jane got into trouble with the censors. How was that?
Tarzan and Jane, well, the best way they get into trouble with the censors, and the original Tarzan and his mate, as it was called, and I mean, just think of the title. It's so, you know, they're not a lawfully wedded couple. They're this sort of biological union, you know, this Tarzan and his mate. That film had early 1934, in the original cut, had a rather explicit nude underwater swimming scene. And that really sent people around the bend in what was not quite then the production code office. And that scene was largely excised, and the Tarzan and his mate become becomes one of these pivotal films that give the production code administrators, or give the original censors in what was then called the Studio Relations Committee, power, because that film was so over the top in what it showed on screen that some forces in the even the studio moguls, I think, realized they might have gone a little too far with that one in the context of the time.
Well, along the lines of Tarzan and his mate, we get to the topic of romance and love and sex and impure love. And what was the reaction of the censors to what they deemed impure love, and how did they define that?
Well, impure love was a euphemism in the production code for homosexual behavior. And in the early 1930s, you had a lot of insinuations and implications of homosexuality in some of the more wisecracking comedies and in some of the melodramas as well. And any reference to this in the context of the code after 1934 would tend to be very subsurface. So you actually, the phrase for it at the time was called pansy humor. And you'd have, you know, basically the kind of stuff that maybe a Nathan Lane would do today, a very kind of over-the-top raging queen would, appear for a couple minutes in a comedy like Sailor's Luck. The most memorable and example of this is in a Wild film with Clara Bow called Call Her Savage, in which she goes to some downtown cafe in New York, and there are a couple of homosexual waiters who flitter around and sing a little cabaret song.
And what about interracial relationships?
Well, it depends on what races you're talking about. That there was a far greater degree of racial and ethnic mixing among the sexes and among men in places like prison and overseas than you'd see after the code. So you get films that often the Chinese gentleman would be a figure of erotic attraction for the white female, usually played, of course, by a man in yellow face. A good example of this is maybe the Barbara Stanwyck film, The Bitter Tea of General Yin. There's also a great fascination with what would have been called the Red Man at the time, the American Indian, as a figure of erotic attraction. And there was a very famous man named Chief Buffalo Child Longlands, who pretended to be an Indian and was an object of erotic attraction for high society and appeared in a couple of films. In terms of black-white relations, it's always much more concealed, and of course in America, much more censored and repressed. You get almost no erotic charges between the sexes, although you do get some validation of the African-American as a strong figure in a couple of pre-code films. I guess the best known one is The Emperor Jones with the great black actor Paul Robeson.
And how successful, once the code is enforced in 1934, how successful was it in suppressing depiction of sin in cinema?
Oh, it was, the thing about the production code is that in Hollywood's terms, and remember, in 1934, the choice isn't between Joseph Breen and the production code and utter freedom of expression. It's between the production code, which is like an efficient, understandable, reliable, predictable form of censorship done in Hollywood, where you can do it, most cheaply, and a whole series of state, municipal censor boards, and perhaps the looming threat of federal censorship. So the production code worked in the sense that it kept the women's organizations and the religious organizations and the government off the backs of Hollywood. They did the censorship themselves at the source. And so they thrive under the production code, economically at least, and certainly I think most of us would look back on that tradition from 1934 to about the mid-60s when, the code is finally abolished, as really a great artistic legacy as well. So for Hollywood's purpose, the production code was a good arrangement.
And we have only a moment left, but how did, for example, Psycho prove to be such a watershed in the code's demise?
Well, a lot of films defeat and crack the production code, but I always think in 1960, although the code isn't really formally ended until 1968, 1958. After Psycho, it's up for grabs. Psycho destroys the moral universe of the production code. It mixes sex and violence, and it does so in an atmosphere of total moral disorder, which is why people of that generation who grew up on the production code will tend to remember where they were when they saw Psycho, because it was so radically different from the production code universe that they had grown up on.
And especially since Hitchcock himself had come out of that universe originally.
Right, yeah. He's sort of the heretic within the universe.
All right, well, thank you very much, Dr. Dougherty.
Hey, my pleasure, Annie.
We have been talking with Dr. Thomas Dougherty, chair of the Film Studies Program at Brandeis University and author of Pre-Code Hollywood, Sex, Immorality, and Insurrection in American Cinema, 1930 through 1934. Because I told you before.